Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching WandaVision. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
This week on the podcast, we are covering episode 3 of WandaVision. This is the second episode of the podcast, but the third episode of the show. It's a little confusing, but that's how Disney released everything. So this will be covering episode 3 of WandaVision. If you have not watched that yet, you know, spoilers ahoy, spoilers ahead. So you might want to press pause and go watch episode 3 of WandaVision. And if you were just joining us for the first time, what Richard and I like to do on this podcast is pick a show that we're watching, watch it closely, break it down, discuss it, bring it to you. Sometimes we have interviews, sometimes we don't. This week we do. We've got director Matt Shakman, who directed every episode of the season. So he is here to talk a little bit about that. And then the second half of this podcast, this series that we're doing on WandaVision, our Vanity Fair colleague Anthony Brasdekin will hop on to go like very comic book deep nerdery with me to cover WandaVision from that angle. So this first half is a sort of a newcomer's approach. Whatever you want to call it. Then we will get more advanced in the second half, including sort of like theory, like comic book informed theories and speculations about what might be happening. In this first half, though, Richard and I will be reading your emails. We've got a bunch of emails about WandaVision. You can always email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And then Richard was like, "Hey, Joanna, can I read an email from time to time?" And I realized I was hogging them. So yes, Richard, do you have any emails that you want to read this week?
Why, I do, actually. Yes, thank you. So we got a bunch, which is exciting. And, people should, because this is such a theory show, that it's nice to kind of open the discourse, outside of you, me, and Anthony. So that said, some of the emails are not necessarily positive thus far, because we're just kind of all getting used to this new show. Sarah Wingo has written to us and saying that, you know, basically that she is kind of the target demo, but she says, "To me, the first two episodes felt like 2 half-hour trailers. I still don't feel like I know anything more about the show than I did before watching them. Nothing about these two episodes made me feel hooked or like there's something I have to tune in for next week. I'm 36 and I watched a lot of Nick at Night 2. The pastiche is fun, but there wasn't enough there." in your first episode about it, you mentioned that the percentage of mystery is about 5 to 10% of each episode, and I'd say that's generous. I just feel like in a season that will be approximately 4.5 hours long, spending the first hour mostly indulging in TV nostalgia with a tiny bit of plot sprinkled in felt very empty. She says some more things, but I think that's kind of the crux of what she was saying. And, you know, I understand what she's saying, and I kind of do feel it. I feel like I filed a review of the first three episodes, expressed a little bit of like, let's get to the meat of it. And I can imagine that it being kind of parsed out in half hour installments each week, people might get a little itchy, but also that might kind of lend or, you know, kind of build the fun aspect of it up. Cause you're really, you know, anticipating something, you know, to be revealed in a way that when you have every episode dumped like on Netflix, that same feeling doesn't quite get as intense.
Yeah, it's true. And I've heard from a bunch of people that they feel like there's not enough mystery, that it's maybe too pastiche loaded in these first two episodes. And I think Sarah definitely is the target demo. I know Sarah from a long time ago. I first met her on Twitter. She was modeling like a Captain Marvel cardigan. And so she is definitely the target demographic for this show. And if it's not working for her, who is it going to work for? But, you know, it's definitely working for some people. And I can only say, I think this episode kicks the mystery into a higher gear. Is my feeling on it. What do you think, Richard?
Yes, I do. I hope that Sarah feels, you know, differently about after watching the third episode, because it is, you know, the mystery machine really starts to hum, you know, I think that they kind of needed to do two episodes of table setting to sort of fully immerse us in the premise. I mean, the premise is not that hard to pick up. It's old TV shows, but I think to kind of lull you into a sense of like, this is the whole world of the show, and then to start picking apart that or zooming out a bit. Maybe those first couple episodes were necessary to get the kind of shock of the end of this episode.
Yeah, and we haven't seen episode 4, so we don't know what the percentage of the mystery is in that show. That's going to be like the 80s set episode, I presume. But, you know, it's already world breaking, this episode 3. You know what I mean? So if you think of the first episode as a pilot, like the first two episodes, which aired together as sort of like a 40-minute, 50-minute pilot, you know, by the second installment, we're already outside the bubble, as it were, and we could talk about what we feel like that means. But I'm curious to see how those people who are impatient for mystery feel after this episode. I we had the advantage of seeing all three episodes together, and the fact that we got to see the end of this episode made me feel like we wouldn't be stuck in pastiche land for too long.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Any other emails you want to read, Richard?
Yeah, just a quick one that takes us kind of into a thought experiment of sorts. Christian writes to us and says, I always found Vision to be one of the least interesting MCU characters. He's always serious and dry. However, I'm really digging WandaVision. It's like Paul Bettany Unleashed. He was excellent in the second episode, especially. Is there a MCU character y'all find on the lower end of the interest spectrum that maybe deserves more exploration? Which I think is an interesting question. And I want to hear your answer first, because I think you know a bit more of the MCU than I do.
I guess I would say the character that I haven't found that interesting in the films has been Hawkeye, which is Jeremy Renner's character. You know, like you look at which characters have gotten Disney Plus shows, and some of them make a tremendous amount of sense, like Tom Hiddleston's Loki, right? Mm-hmm. That is a huge fan favorite in any iteration that he shows up in the MCU. I think they realized, you know, they killed him off for dramatic effect. They're bringing him back, and that feels like a slam dunk, no brainer, right?
Yeah.
But the fact that Jeremy Renner's Hawkeye is getting his own show, I think to some people who are only familiar with the MCU might be like, him? what is he, funny? I'm really excited for that show, actually, because you know, it's clear that they're basing it a bit off. I don't know exactly how it's going to fit in with the entire MCU continuity, but it's clear that they're basing it off this great Matt Fraction run of the comics called Hawkeye, where Hawkeye is working a lot with a younger female archer named Kate Bishop, and they've cast Hailee Steinfeld as that character. That Hawkeye in that comic run is so lovable, and he's very different from who Jeremy Renner has played. And he's also like a single young guy, and Jeremy Renner is playing like a family man in the movie. So I don't quite know how exactly they're going to make that work, but I love that Hawkeye on the page. And I'm really interested to see if they can get Renner's Hawkeye enough in that place where I feel super excited about following that character. But like, if I didn't know about those comic books, I'd be like, why am I getting a Hawkeye TV show? Right. But I am excited because of those comic books. So that's, you know, I consider him as, you know, he's a minor Avenger. Mm-hmm. That's someone I would consider. How about you, Richard?
Well, I mean, I am very intrigued by the briefly glimpsed Proxima Midnight played by the great Carrie Coon, in Infinity War. She's a villain. That would be harder to do. If we had enough anti-heroes. So I'm going to say the MCU character I would like to see more of, maybe in their own standalone series, is the character Christine Everhart, played by Leslie Bibb, a reporter in Iron Man. I think she might be in one of the sequel. Because I think it would be kind of fun. What does a reporter do in an era of like Thanos and superheroes and aliens and Viking gods or whatever? Like, how does that affect, like, do you have to write a lot of clickbait about like what was, you know, Black Widow wearing at the, you know, like, I don't know. And I think that would be a really, you know, if WandaVision is presented as like, look at all the different forms Marvel content can take. Well, how about like kind of a workplace dramedy about a journalist who just happens to be reporting a lot on like the craziness of superheroes?
And do you recall where Christine Everhart works, Richard?
I believe, does she work for Vanity Fair?
She's a Vanity Fair reporter.
I had forgotten that, but maybe that's why I was just drawn to her that much more.
Yeah, who sleeps with the subject of the cover. The whole premise
of Vanity Fair.
The whole premise of that character, who like ambushes Tony Stark at a fancy party to tell him she's writing a profile of him, which is not how those things work at all, and then sleeps with him. I was like, yeah, there's a whole run of stories of people working for Vanity Fair just like showing up and like sleeping with people or lying to them. And I was just like, who do you think we are at Vanity Fair?
We're a bunch of nerds. We're not doing that, man.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Any other emails that you want to take a crack at, Richard?
I don't have any in front of me, but I think, do you have a couple maybe?
I do have a couple. All right. So this one comes from Lisa, and she says, hello, still watching Friends. What are the chances that my BF, Dan Stevens, will appear in the Marvel Universe? Aren't Legion and Scarlet Witch first cousins? That being said, I haven't gone further into Legion past the FX series, so I'm not sure where he goes beyond that, but it seems like those two would have one hell of a battle. By the way, I found that the House of M Ultimate Edition is free on Kindle if you have Amazon Prime. Love from across the YOLO Causeway, Lisa. All right, so Dan Stevens in Legion. Richard, you watched like season one of Legion, right?
I watched a few episodes, mostly for Gene Smart.
You know, Legion ran for three seasons on FX and then was sort of part of one of the victims of this like shutting down all these extraneous Marvel TV shows to sort of coalesce them under the Disney Plus banner and the Kevin Feige auspices. So what is true is that Kevin Feige is bringing some characters from like at least some of the Netflix shows into his TV universe in a way that makes them feel connected. I'm not sure he will extend that favor to Legion. When, you know, the interview that we ran with Kevin Feige last week on the podcast, he said that this idea of mutants, because Legion, the titular character that Dan Stevens plays in Legion, is a mutant. This idea of mutants is something that they're looking to use going forward, but not necessarily going backwards. So I don't know that they're going to absorb other mutants that they've explored into this universe. But I don't know. It would be fun. I mean, like, more Dan Stevens, yes, always, right, Richard?
Yeah, yeah. And maybe they could be kissing cousins, you know?
Ooh!
I don't know. It's all crazy, the rules there. Well, I mean, it's just crazy how, like, it's really wild, yeah. Like, how my boyfriend plays this phone game called Marvel Contest of Champions, I think it's called. And, like, there's just... there are so many characters, and sometimes I'll look over his shoulder while he's playing, and I'm like, okay, now who's that? And how do they relate to this? And are they Avengers? Are they X-Men? But they're all, you know, of course, under the same big umbrella. So you really could go a lot of different directions. But I think, yes, like you said, introducing the concept of mutants into this other, you know, sort of track in the Marvel lore, actually, I think might be, like, trickier than it sounds initially.
I think it's definitely something they're going to do. Some people theorize this is even something this show might do because, you know, maybe because I will just say famously, that emailer mentioned the comic book House of M, which, you know, most folks understand is an inspiration for this season of television. In that comic book, mutants do exist. But Wanda in that comic book actually gets rid of them. There's a very famous panel from that comic where Wanda says, no more mutants, and gets rid of mutants. Most of them anyway.
Does she say it to the tune of Mary J. Blige's No More Drama?
Absolutely. That's how I read it every time. Okay, but she, you know, so there's some theories that maybe this will end with, like, what? Yes, more mutants? I don't know. Like, some opposite of that where she will somehow create mutants in this world. There's going to have to be some kind of event for the MCU, which has all this continuity, to introduce mutants now when they couldn't legally have them before because of the rights issues with Fox. There's going to be some kind of event, and, you know, you better believe that they are trying to figure out how to best execute that. Whether it's like a, you know, Wanda with all of her powers does something, or, you know, there's an alternate universe with mutants. Anything's possible. The comic book, you know, we could have a TV show about a Vanity Fair reporter, and you never know.
And we should.
All right. This last email comes from Amanda, and it deals directly with some of our questions, probably based to this episode. So I think it'll be a good segue into us talking about specifically episode 3. Amanda says, I'm coming to WandaVision with very little MCU knowledge, only having seen a movie here and there, mostly on plane rides. Remember those? Weirdly, one of the four of the movies I've seen in the MCU is Avengers Age of Ultron, so I vaguely remember Scarlet Witch and Jarvis/Vision. I do have a couple thoughts that I want to share and see your take on them. Number one, in the first episode, when Agnes introduces herself, she says something about moving in so quickly, which could be taken as Wanda magically unpacked. But I think it could also be that Wanda and Vision were dropped into this place. Number two, at the dinner with the boss in the first episode, Mr. and Mrs. Hart seemed to be trying to make small talk. They asked where they came from and why they are there, which leads into the alternate reality theory. But I don't think it's necessarily created by Scarlet Witch because she has no answers. Which, number three, another thing that makes me think they are in a reality not created by Scarlet Witch is we get to see Vision without Wanda, like at work or the neighborhood watch meeting. I understand wanting to give the show more texture with giving Vision scenes without Wanda, but I think if it was only in her mind, there would be less Vision backstory. Also, Wanda didn't know what the heart on the calendar was, and it was Vision that figured it out while at work without her. She also didn't know what happened to him with the gum at the talent show, which, again, why would she not know what was happening? Anyway, thank you for everything that you do, and I love hearing about all these shows. So there's this question. We touched on it a little bit last week, but I think it's even safer to talk about more plainly with episode 3 of, like, this is some sort of bubble created reality, mm-hmm. right? Because we see Geraldine get kicked out of it.
Yeah.
Who is creating it? Who is controlling it? What's your perception so far, Richard?
Well, I think that kind of leads to, like, my big question for you about this episode in particular. I mean, we've seen this symbol before, this kind of upside down sword, right?
Yeah.
On the little toy helicopter. And then we see it on a necklace that Geraldine is wearing, which is really when Wanda kind of turns on her And yes. It's like, what, who are you or what, you know, like, so my question about that is that a symbol of some sort of organization, like something Hydra adjacent or I don't know what, or is it some kind of talisman to like protect people? But why would it be on a toy helicopter right now? So I think that Wanda's suspicion about it would lead me to believe that it represents an outside force that is controlling things versus it being interior to her.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple options. These are great questions. The symbol belongs to an organization that is known to Marvel comic book readers. It is called SWORD. So, like, you might be familiar with SHIELD, like Agents of SHIELD. Mm. That's an acronym. This is SWORD. SWORD historically is not an evil organization, so it's not like a Hydra adjacent thing. But, you know, the MCU likes to mess with things, so you never know. But we've seen it, yeah, on that helicopter, on the necklace, on the back of the beekeeper guy. Like, we've seen it around. And so it does seem to sort of trigger something in Wanda, and she forcibly ejects this person who is wearing that symbol.
It also triggers for me the kind of fun, like, kind of spine tingle thing of the Dharma symbol, or the was a swan, right? Wasn't it in Lost? This kind of like a sort of visual mystery, a sort of, you know, sort of, or pattern. I think is kind of fun and harkens very closely to that show.
One fun theory that I really like so SWORD, when we see at the end of episode one, like the SWORD logo on whoever is like watching, you know, we saw that like pullback into a monitor that was like watching the show that Wanda and Vision were creating here.
I assumed that was Ed Harris in a
in the moon,
in like a beret or whatever his hat was in that moon.
Yeah, wearing a beret in the moon. But the SWORD logo is there, so whoever's watching her is SWORD. I think the best theory that I know of is that, so there's this bubble reality. Wanda is in some kind of control over it, right? She's able to sort of like rewind things, sort of reset things with Vision when he starts asking too many questions.
Yes, right.
She has some kind of control over it, and she seems invested in keeping it fun and light and sitcom-y, right? Like, she wants this fantasy to keep going. She ejects Geraldine for intruding with the reality of, like, oh, your brother was killed by Ultron and stuff like that, right? She rejects that. One fun theory I've seen is that the helicopter that we see in, okay, so let's say Wanda has created this reality, or she is running this reality now, and she, things from the outside world that come in and intrude, she has to remake them so that they fit into the reality. So let's say that toy helicopter was actually like a real helicopter, but she turned it into a toy so that it would fit in this like little neighborhood, right? Or let's say the beekeeper was actually like some guy in a hazmat suit, and she just sort of like reinterpreted it in a way that would fit this reality. Or let's say that Geraldine is an agent of SWORD who comes in and she sort of like loses her memory a bit as she's in, you know, like you get sort of warped into the reality once you're there. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So an idea that I think is interesting is like the helicopter crashes or intrudes into this reality between episode one and episode two. And in episode two, we get a bunch of new characters, including Geraldine and several other new neighbors, Emma Caulfield from Buffy, et cetera. So one fun theory is that they actually like arrived on the helicopter, and maybe they're all working for SWORD and they're trying to get Wanda out of there, or they're doing it to her. You know, are they the villains or are they the heroes? It's unclear. Do you know?
Well, right. And I think that, you know, we've seen things like movies and shows in the past that have been sort of like set in like a kind of like mind palace, and like the owner of it, you know, the possessor of the mind is like really intent on not, you know, losing the fantasy or whatever. And I think that like there would be a good or an understandable kind of, you know, psychological reason for Wanda to do that, because this is where Vision is alive still.
Right.
Right. And so she could be very protective over that, even though it is really synthetic and creepy things are happening, et cetera, et cetera. And I almost wonder, I mean, it's interesting that the Legion question came up, because, you know, we have, there are like X-Men like Jean Grey and other ones who have telepathic abilities, and sometimes it becomes like too much, like they get lost in a kind of like,
right,
you know, fugue state or something, because of their sort of powers. And I wonder, like, maybe that, maybe Wanda kind of dangerously created this thing and it's harmful to her as well as other people potentially. So, but still the kind of inner want, the id or whatever it is clinging onto it, while her kind of more empathic, intellectual side, would probably, you know, do otherwise.
Right, right. No, I think that's, there are a lot of parallels in other shows and films where we've seen a similar thing. And I think that's a really good point. I think to Amanda's point of maybe Wanda isn't the original architect of this bubble is interesting. And that's another fun theory that's floating around, which is like, she's controlling the bubble in a certain way now because she's so powerful. But maybe it was created by someone else originally and she walked into it to try to stop it or rescue that person or whatever. And then she got sucked into it and then becomes the architect of it in her own way because she's so powerful. But this idea that it existed before her, like she arrives in the neighborhood. Catherine Hahn's character is already there. And a lot of people think maybe that character, the Agnes character, is actually, you know, because there's that weird scene with the neighbor where he's like trimming the hedge, mm-hmm. and he's and she's sort of like, isn't it interesting that Geraldine doesn't have a home? What's going on there? And then he starts to say something and she sort of shuts him up. And so, like, you know, there's a lot of imagery, there's a lot of witchy imagery around Catherine Hahn's character Agnes. So there's this, like, there's this idea that she is the original creator of the bubble. Let's say Wanda went in as an Avenger, as a superhero, went in to try to like stop it, whatever it was, if it's a threat of some kind, and then got absorbed into it.
Right.
The way that all these other characters are getting absorbed into it.
Kind of, you know? Like that Black Mirror episode where it's like fake Star Trek with Jesse Plemons.
Yes.
Have to kind of play along because the person who has control over the world is very dangerous.
Yeah,
And I think also if we're thinking about the Marvel film continuity, I mean, we are because we talked about Vision being dead.
Yeah.
You know, when Wanda was first introduced, she was powerful, but she wasn't like Captain Marvel level, you know, like galactic being kind of thing. But then in Endgame, when she kind of makes her, you know, kind of attack on Thanos on her own, it seems like she's kind of leveled up, maybe several levels. And so I wonder if that's kind of like part of this. It's like, it's not a Dark Phoenix narrative exactly, but it's with great power comes a kind of unwieldy, you know, control over it. And maybe that's what we're seeing, is that she kind of opened a door of some sorts within her abilities. And now it's like kind of all spilling out.
I do think we're looking at a leveling up for sure. And like the last thing that is so central to this episode that I want to mention is this idea of like children, which is kind of interesting because, you know, obviously she's having this like magical pregnancy, you know, it fits into the wacky sitcom plot of her going into labor, her powers going all haywire because she's going into labor, etc. She gives birth to these twins and that happens in the comics as well, that Wanda has a pair of twin boys, Billy and Tommy, you know, with Vision, etc. But when you couple that with what happens in episode 2, you'll notice episode 2 is all about this like talent show that they're putting on, right? This fundraiser. And they keep saying like for the children, right? In this creepy sort of hot fuzz, like for the greater good kind of way, right? Mm-hmm. For the children. They keep saying it. But what's interesting about episodes 1 and 2, you never see any children. There are no children. They keep saying for the children, and there are no children. Like, where are all the children that they're talking about? And then here in episode three, Wanda gives birth to a couple babies. And so, you know, a question, a theory that doesn't necessarily have a direct answer in the comic books is, like, does someone need Wanda to have those babies? And is that why she's having those babies? Is this a slightly Rosemary's Baby sort of situation?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah.
So
that makes sense. And I it's interesting. I mean, I know that something that some watchers of the films took issue with was, like the narrative about Natasha Romanoff, like Black Widow's, what was it? Like a forced hysterectomy or something. And so she said, I can't have children. And people thought, well, that's kind of reductive to, like, of course, the woman's pain has to do with childbirth. And you know, so maybe this is a different way of handling that topic in a more complex way. So maybe not they're not trying to fix anything. I mean, who knows how they'll address it in the Black Widow movie. But, you know, again, they were written by the same person.
Yeah, it's true. So, you know, all of that being sort of like what may or may not be going on. Who is the original architect of this thing? Is it Catherine Hahn's character? Is Catherine Hahn's character also trapped there? Who's in control? Why are the twins there, etc.? Like, these are all the, like, mystery speculation stuff that's going on. What about this, like, 70s Brady Bunch Partridge Family pastiche of an episode? Does this work for you as on that level, Richard?
Oh yeah, they nailed the color palette. Just the set design and the costumes, but the film stock or something. I mean, it's not shot on film or anything, but, like, you know, the way that the filming interacts with those colors and sort of filters them, I thought was like with those really, like, deep browns and the kind of greens, like, it just really worked. I thought, I think this is where, of the three episodes, it was more kind of referenced by, like, several shows versus one particular one. Like, I think the house was definitely Brady Bunch, but think there were other, I mean, you mentioned Partridge Family, there were other influences where the first episode was, you know, depending on how you read it, either exactly Dick Van Dyke or exactly I Love Lucy, or maybe more of a mix, but, like, the episode two is definitely Bewitched, you know? So I thought it was interesting. Well, I guess maybe there was I Dream of Jeannie in there too. I should be fair. So I guess
anyway. I think like there's usually like one living room we're looking at. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
which gives us like, you know, so this is the Brady Bunch.
Right.
It's not quite the Brady Bunch living room, but the way the staircase is and the stone wall, like, that's a Brady Bunch living room. But yeah, we're like living in a sort of Partridge Family kind of 70s wacky kind of world. Like, the opening credits feel more Partridge Family than Brady Bunch to me.
Well,
so,
no, there was no Partridge. There was a stork, though.
Yeah, there was. So and I loved, like, you know, one last thing I want to say about, like, the episode as an episode rather than, like, our comic book theories is Tiana Paris, who plays Geraldine in Universe. Most people know this at this point, that, I mean, I think it's fair to say now that she's been booted out, I think I can say that she's playing Monica Rambeau, who's Maria Rambeau, who's Carol Danvers' like best friend in the Captain Marvel movie. And Monica Rambeau is like her daughter who's in that movie. This is her daughter grown up. This is Monica Rambeau. That's in like all the promos, so I'm not spoiling anything by saying
IMDb.
That, but like,
yeah.
So she's Monica Rambeau. So what I thought was really fun is in this scene where she's talking about like her job and like, you know, they're doing all that sort of wacky physical comedy with the stork wandering around. Tiana Paris is doing this like interesting code switching thing, right? Between this like groovy black best friend 70s neighbor type of character, and then her voice changes completely when she starts talking about like Ultron and Wanda's brother Quicksilver, who you guys may or may not remember was played by Aaron Taylor Johnson in Avengers Age of Ultron and was killed in that movie. And so she's referencing that, so that like that persona that she drops. And I think Katherine Hahn does a similar kind of drop in this episode, so it's sort of fun to watch these very talented actresses play those levels, you know?
Yeah, and I think it also, you know, brought in some interesting thematic stuff to think about in terms of race. You know, if this is, if the most direct lift that this show is doing, this episode is doing, is from the Brady Bunch, like, it were really rare to see anyone of color on that show. especially right. in that living room, you know. I think there was, you know, there was an episode with, I think it was Desi Arnaz Jr. or someone, or the elder Freddie Prinze, or, you know, they occasionally had people of color on the Brady Bunch, but not normally. But of course, during the 70s, there was, you know, All in the Family, which led to the Jeffersons. Like there was that whole other tradition of 1970s Norman Lear kind of show that, obviously they're bringing into bear here. And yet then she's immediately cast out of this, you know, very white kind of setting. So I thought that was an interesting commentary. And Teyonah Parris is just like such a good, compelling actor. And it was really, really fun watching her in that long scene.
All right. Well, is there anything else you want to say about this episode in particular?
No, I guess not. I mean, I really am. This is the episode, you know, because we saw this earlier because I had to review it. This was the one that kind of really hooked me because, you know, I think something I was complaining about about the first two episodes, much like Sarah said in her email, that like, okay, like, let's get to the point, you know, and I think this really did a good job of marrying the kind of homage-y satire of old television with the mystery stuff. I'm excited to see more. I guess we should probably give a programming note, right, about when these episodes are going to start airing going forward.
Yeah, so this is going to drop a little later than it did the first time on Friday, but we still got to see this episode in advance. We will not be able to see any of the upcoming episodes in advance. Episode 4 on, we will be getting the same time the rest of you will, which is like, I think, midnight on a Thursday night. So the earliest we'll be able to record is on a Friday. So, you know, we don't want to put our producer Dave under the gun to, you know, jam these out on a work day where he has another job, etc. So, you know, the best case scenario, these are going to drop on Friday afternoons. They might drop over the weekend, though. We don't know. We will do our best to get them to you in a timely manner. But that is the constraint we're working under. So that's the schedule going forward.
And I'll just add before you, I throw it over to you and Anthony, or actually, I guess the interview. But is that there is actually another spoiler on the WandaVision IMDb page. So if you don't want to be further spoiled, don't look at it. Just a word of warning.
Oh, I don't even know what you're talking
about. Well, it's not a mild spoiler.
All right. So, let us go first to our interview with director Matt Shakman. And then we will be coming back with Anthony Breskin. And Richard, we will see you next week.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork. And this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
I wanted to start by asking you, you mentioned that, you know, you took there was a couple months off, corona induced, between the first stage of filming and the last. And I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned that there are some things you realized that you wanted to do maybe differently, or most importantly, when you got back. Can you, in a spoiler-free way, can you talk about sort of the most important revelation of that time off gave you?
Yeah, well, you know, we did shut down. We shut down at a very interesting moment, though, because we had just wrapped in Atlanta and we were starting pre-production for our LA shoot. So it worked out well in that we were not in the middle and we had to sort of stop in the middle of filming. We were actually at a pause point. And then we jumped into post-production and we were able to polish up everything that we had shot already. And because it's such a giant project, you know, you can never fully prep everything as a director before you start shooting, and you're kind of doing this rolling prep. So as we worked on post-production, I was able to storyboard and do previs and figure out sort of on a more detailed level some of the things that I had upcoming. So that was really useful as a director. But narratively, it was pretty much locked in. You know, this is a real puzzle box, and we had worked out our elements there. And, you know, we had shot bits and pieces of all the episodes already. So it wasn't like we were going one at a time anyway. It was mostly just an opportunity to jump into post-production earlier than we would have. And it's been a bit schizophrenic as a director, because usually you prep, you shoot, you edit, you finish, you hand it off. And in this particular case, it's sort of been all stages of the process at once. So it's scoring and it's VFX and it's, I'm also shooting, wait a minute, and I'm also editing. And so, but it's been fun too, because the whole show is by its nature schizophrenic anyway. It's so many different eras and styles that why not?
And then I was just talking to Kevin, and he said one of his favorite things that you did to sort of have fun with the era switches were the aspect ratio changes. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that idea when that came to you, and sort of what, if there's anything beyond era switches that we should be looking out for in terms of those aspect ratio changes.
We play a lot with form and style in the show. And that's one of the fun things about it. Like playing with form becomes a kind of narrative in the show in a way. And it tells you something about the story. I don't want to say anything more than that, except we always wanted to be authentic. And so when we were going to do a 50s era sitcom, it had to be 4:3. And that was one of the early questions, was, you know, just making sure that Disney Plus, with this wonderful new streaming service, that they wouldn't be surprised when I delivered this Marvel show in 4:3, you know, this old fashioned box format. And everyone was excited about it. So we were able to roll forward with that. But also, you know, this has always been described as a mix of classic sitcom and large scale Marvel action. And large scale Marvel action is usually in what we call 2:39 widescreen, you know. So, you know, you can do the math and sort of figure out where those opportunities might lie. But I have really enjoyed playing around with different lenses, period lighting, different styles of filmmaking, doing things in front of a live audience on a set that's designed for that, you know, kind of open like a stage set, and also then jumping to a show that would have been done four walls with a single camera and lots of effects on wires and rods and things. This show has been a real journey through kind of every different filmmaking technique you could possibly imagine.
I wanted to ask you about those fun old fashioned effects that you used in some of the early episodes. Was there any particular effect that was so tricky to pull off with the rods and the wires that you were like, why can't we do this digitally? It would be so much easier if we could.
We definitely had those conversations, but you know, we couldn't take the easy road. I mean, this show is all about that authenticity and creating that world. And I think there is a real tension that comes between a modern looking effect in those eras and the sort of Bewitched, I Dream of Jeannie style effects. And the tension between those two things is really a part of the story and a part of the storytelling as well. So, I mean, I remember very vividly, like it was yesterday, sitting down with Dan Sudik, who's a special effects coordinator, who's done all of the big Marvel movies and nominated for many Oscars, an amazing guy who can blow anything up and build spaceships and whatever. And sort of sheepishly sort of getting my courage up to be like, Dan, I think most of the time, at least for a good chunk of the game, I want to just do old fashioned wires and rods, and expecting him to kind of laugh me out of the room. And he just got so excited. And he told me that he came up under the guys who did Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. And early in his career, he had done that kind of stuff. And it was like, you know, finding an old lost musical instrument and dusting it off and figuring out, how do we play this thing? And, you know, getting these wonderful special effects technicians up into the rafters and hiding under kitchen islands and making this magic happen. And I think all of us who think, of course, that we do all these fancy, new, sophisticated filmmaking techniques, you look back in the 50s and 60s and go, oh, that was all so simple then. You know, all of us were like, they were good. That was hard, you know, and it was true of the actors too, you know, Lizzie having to like freeze and oppose, and then we would have to like put stands under her arms, and her stand-in would stand in front. They would like mirror each other, and then Lizzie would run off and do a quick change and like run back and like match her stand-in, the rods away and action, you know, to create those quick changes and things. And it's hard, but it's charming, you know, and it's, yeah. If you don't do it the way they did it, you can't really make it feel like the way they did it, you know.
One of my favorite things about this sort of news cycle around this show is people talking about your personal work as an actor, as a young child actor on sitcoms. I loved Just the Ten of Us as a kid, honestly. But you've also gone on to direct a bunch of modern, you know, comedies, a million episodes of It's Always Sunny. Is there anything you had to unlearn sort of comedy technique wise when trying to direct these earlier era comedies?
It's interesting. You're definitely right that, you know, when I was working on sitcoms, there certainly is there's a rhythm to it. You know, you Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday rehearsal, Thursday camera blocking, Friday tape day. And that was the rhythm of my life as a kid, you know? And so when we started WandaVision with that, we started with a live audience for the first episode. It really felt familiar. It felt like for the first time in many years, you know, since I was a kiddo, I was back in that rhythm again, you know, rehearsing, getting ready and doing it and putting on the show. And it brought back a lot of fond memories. It was great. But I do direct a lot of theater, and there's something very similar to that, like putting on a show and how an audience affects a performance. So that's why we did that first show in front of an audience, is to have that energy that those shows in the 50s, like I Love Lucy and Dick Van Dyke, had when they had an audience there. But yeah, you know, I mean, every style is different. Comedy changes. I don't know. It's like a snake shedding its skin. It's amazing how, you know, just Will Ferrell movies, you know, a certain kind of Will Ferrell movie, like, you know, worked really well 10 years ago, maybe doesn't work as well right now, but it worked great in 5 years from now. Or, you know, Dick Van Dyke and Jim Carrey, like very similar physical comedians. And yet there's a big gap in that middle, you know, where different kinds of comedy come and go. So we tried to study and kind of figure out sort of what was the sort of approach to comedy in each era? What was the approach to acting? And you know, what was naturalism? What was comedy? These were the questions we were kind of asking ourselves as we went.
Yeah, I love that. One of my favorite things that I heard Lizzie say was that it was, you know, this interview will go with episode 3. And episode 3 is the one where she said you had to, like, the first time you had to tell her to dial it back because she was like a little too Lucy or something like that in her episode.
So. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I do remember that moment where I went in there. I was like, I think we're getting too big here. That they were, her and Paul were both like, what? No. We had so much fun. And we did play with levels the whole time, because that's a big part of getting a tone like that, is making sure that you do have options and that you try the more grounded option, you try the really silly option, because you're not really sure ultimately when you start to put the whole thing together, you know, how you want to modulate it. And yeah, those two especially are wonderful at that. And they're so hardworking. They plan so much. They're so prepared, and they're really game to sort of try lots of different things.
Yeah, I imagine it would be really hard to, you know, I also grew up watching a lot of Nick at Night. I watched the Dick Van Dyke Show. I watched all of that. And it's amazing to me how you capture the tone without, you know, smothering in irony or, you know, sneering at it any kind of way. It just feels like a love letter, like genuinely engaging with what the tone was at the time. So
that was definitely the goal. Yeah. We didn't want to move into parody or spoof at all. This is the reality of that episode, the reality for those characters, and that this is what they're living. Yeah.
So, you know, this is a Marvel property. So of course you've got the sort of eagle-eyed, well-studied nerds already poring over screenshots from trailers and stuff like that. They've already spotted a potential wine bottle Easter egg in the first episode. I'm wondering, is this the kind of show where we should be watching in every corner for clues and hints and details, and keeping our like conspiracy theory yarn wall going, the whole time we're watching it?
Gotcha. Well, you know, the show is a mystery and a bit of a thriller, and there's a puzzle to it, of course. And so information that helps inform the solution to that puzzle is certainly in the show. But, you know, I would never want to say look super carefully or don't look at all. You know, hopefully the show stands on its own, and the experience of it will be satisfying as it goes and when it wraps up.
So meet it at the level that you want to meet it. And it can be rewarding if you're just casually watching it. And if you're a weirdo like me, you can watch every frame. Okay.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, you know, you talked about this already, about like sort of the idea of comedy, like a snake shedding its skin. I really like that idea. I'm fascinated thinking about the evolution of, like, you know, because these are family sitcom genres that you're exploring, the evolution of like the sitcom wife or the sitcom existence, and thinking about like these early episodes and how they're all about like hiding who you are and hiding your truth and fear of being discovery and wanting to fit in and conform. And then you've got later stuff, you know, we already know that Roseanne is going to be an homage later on. And Roseanne is such a, like, you know, screw your notion of what family is supposed to be. This is our real family here. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about like that specific way in which the family sitcom evolved over the decades.
It's a great question. We did focus on family sitcoms because this is a love story, and this is about two people who, you know, are creating a family for each other. They've both been lonely. Vision is one of a kind, you know, he's on his own, and Wanda has, you know, lost so much, and they come together and they create this unit. And so that is what, you know, that's why we looked at those amazing sitcoms throughout time that still resonate today. The ones that like I Love Lucy and Dick Van Dyke, all the way up to today, the ones that really feel like they're meant to last and that they're timeless. All of them have something similar to them, which I love, which is that there's always a problem. And it's whatever the crisis of the episode happens to be, but it's always a problem that you can solve if you work together as a family, you know? And those kinds of, you know, shenanigans and the sort of sitcom level of crisis and chaos is a wonderful one, because it means that, you know, no problem is insurmountable, you know, and no problem cannot be fixed if we work together.
I love that answer, but at the same time, I feel like the show also has this, you know, this almost eerie David Lynchian Twin Peaksy, like the menace below, you know, the suburbs sort of vibe to it, that like it seems like you've solved the problem in a half an hour, but there's a bigger problem or bigger threat sort of lurking. Why, you know, this is my last question to you, like sort of why was that something that was interesting for you to explore right now?
It's true. I mean, I would go back to what I said about it being a bit of a puzzle box. I mean, obviously there is a intentionality to how we've structured the show and the worlds that we're occupying. And that will be sort of revealed as you watch it, you know? But yes, nothing is what it seems, right? And things can move quickly from Dick Van Dyke to Twilight Zone. And it's all a part of this question that Wanda and Vision are asking themselves, which is, you know, what's going on here? And where exactly are we?
Where are we? When are we? Perfect. Thanks so much, Matt. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good one.
You too. Bye.
The Run Through of Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
Yeah, we support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOC.
Can you tell us what AWOC means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOC.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Hello and welcome to part two, part three, however you care to break these episodes down. This is the section of the podcast where my pal Anthony Breskin is here. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Joe. We're in the bubble. Or are we outside the bubble?
I think we're in the bubble, man.
All right. We're in the bubble.
We're here to talk about the first three episodes of WandaVision, like sort of as a whole,
through the lens of comic book knowledge. So while we will not be spoiling anything from any future episodes, because we have not seen them, we will be talking about a lot of comic book stuff that helps us understand and unpack. I feel like I really have a much better grasp on what's going on after this week's episode than I did after the first two, and a lot of good comic book stuff to dive into. We're going to talk about animals. We're going to talk about twins. We're going to talk about Wonder Man. We've got all kinds of stuff to talk about.
And bubble baths.
And bubble baths. Yeah, so let's start by looking back at something, you know, I think it's fair to say that Anthony and I were both a little embarrassed by having a lack of a theory on the commercials that we see in the first two episodes, and we see a third one in this episode. We've got the toaster commercial, the watch commercial, and then this week we got the Hydra soap commercial. So Anthony's going to talk about that third commercial, but first I want to – we got a lot of emails and tweets and all kinds of stuff from you guys about the commercials. So let me just read one really quickly. This comes
We dropped the ball. Joe and I were texting like, how did we miss this?
I know.
How?
Mortified.
In our defense, I think we were focused on the episode so much that the commercials felt like we didn't have a lot to go on. And I think, you know, that wasn't our primary focus, but we missed it. We totally dropped the ball.
I'm still pretty mortified. So this came from a listener, Manu, who is actually a pal of mine. I've known him from the Game of Thrones days. And he tweeted at me, he goes, "Hey, Joe, sorry to theory at you, but I read the toaster commercial and waiting for the toast to pop as Pietro's story about how he and Wanda waited in the rubble for the Stark missile to blow, with the second commercial being the Strucker adjacent, if I'm tracking, commercials. They're all going to tie to Wanda's origin story, or maybe the time of these events closer to Age of Ultron than we thought." And then Grant, another listener from the Thrones era, says to me, "The toaster commercial with Stark Industries, the watch commercial with Strucker. On one level, the commercials are about each of their origins, Wanda's origins, Vision's origin, trauma, the toaster, the bleeping red light on the toaster being the Stark bomb, I think is the sort of smartest, sharpest analogy that people have drawn." Do you have anything to add about those two commercials before we get to the third one, Anthony?
I just think they're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I felt like, you know, at the end of Scrooged, when Bill Murray goes on TV and he... and he speaks to his brother, you know, with the Ghost of Christmas Past. He had watched them playing like Trivial Pursuit, and his brother had been trying to make him a better person all along, and he didn't listen. And then he's like, "And you were right about everything, except the SS Minnow." The SS Minnow is the ship that took the castaways to Gilligan's Island. No points this round. And the brother is like, "How did he know we missed that one?" Like, I feel like it was you and I were both like, "How did we miss this? How did they know and we didn't?"
It was really embarrassing. I will say one thing that I have been told, I need to double check it, I might do it right now while we're talking, is that there is a 666 on the side of the toaster, and we will get to why that might be a little later on this episode. Before we get there, want to talk to me about this third commercial that we got in this episode, Anthony?
Yeah, it's basically a takeoff on the old Calgon, Take Me Away commercials, where someone washes away their stress with the warmth and relaxation of a bubble bath. Only it's called, what is it called, Hydralox? I'm blanking on the exact name of it, but it's something with Hydra. Hydra is
right.
The soap. And it says something like, "Unleash the goddess within."
Yeah.
Which is a very deliberate phrase, I believe. And the goddess is a character from Marvel history. Not such deep history. It's from the 90s. I believe the character was invented by Jim Starlin. And she was sort of the light side of a character called Adam Warlock. And here's where I'll say, I think this is a case where if they are going to draw something from this character, it's an illusion. They're not going to follow the comics strictly. They're going to maybe take a notion or an idea and weave it in, because we haven't even met Adam Warlock in any of the Marvel Cinematic Universe projects so far. So I doubt that they're going to, dive really deep into that. And I think that's something to keep in mind as we theorize, is that as much as we love to like wonder about what's going on in the Marvel world, they usually keep it pretty close to the surface. Like, we can plunge into the depths of mythology and lore, and usually it's like, yeah, we took that name. And, like, that's about it. Yeah, the character Adam Warlock, he had his hands on the Infinity Gauntlet, and he wanted to be a good ruler, somebody who ruled through logic and decency. And so he had his good, his sort of like softy side and his harsh side removed, and they split into two different enemies, one called the Magus and one called the Goddess. And the Goddess was the light and the Magus was the dark entity. And so...
Oh, that's interesting.
I think maybe what they were going for here was perhaps a little wink. I think they're drawing on what were the traumas that that Wanda has experienced, and of course with Hydra, she was battling against Hydra, and she killed a bunch of people in a building. That was one of the things that led to the Sokovia Accords and the concern that superheroes were maybe more dangerous than they were worth. And so she, ever since that point, she had been trying to control herself and make sure that she only used her powers for good and was more careful and cautious with them. So Unleash the Goddess Within, I think, is maybe just a little tip of the hat toward Wanda wanting to use her powers for good, yearning to use her powers for good.
But having the potential to be very dangerous and very dark,
the awareness that even intending to do good with her powers could have side effects that that are awful.
That's so interesting. The other detail that some folks have noticed is that there's this exchange in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You might remember in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that Agent Coulson had sort of his reality reconfigured with this like trip to Tahiti. Do you remember that at the beginning of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Right.
Right. And there's this exchange where he's talking to another character. He says, "I would have figured it out a long time ago if it wasn't for the mind control soap." And the other character goes, "Wait, what?" And he goes, "The blue soap everyone uses? Hydra loads it up with chemicals. It seeps into our bloodstream and plants false memories into our brains. They want us to believe this is a magical place. But don't worry, I'm clear. I make my own soap now." So this idea of like blue soap and its history, I'm not saying this is literally the same soap, but I am saying like its connection to like creating a false reality. Like the commercial is very much about like creating an escapist fantasy to escape a nightmare. And like that is, we think, partially maybe what's going on with Wanda here. So I think it's working on a couple different levels there.
Yeah, I will confess I did not keep tabs on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So that's news to me. Good catch.
Yeah, soap. All right, so we're going to start with Agnes. We're going to have a whole journey. We're going to start with Agnes. Agnes is, we talked about this in the first episode, but Agnes, we believe, is actually, and I think there's much more evidence in this episode, that she is not just, you know, an innocent bystander here in the bubble, as indicated by some like furtive conversation she's having. But she might actually be a comic book character known as Agatha Harkness, who is a witch from the Salem times. There's a couple extra clues. First of all, in this episode, you might want to go back and look at what shoes she's wearing. She's wearing pilgrim shoes with like big silver buckles on them. So that's a fun, one might have worn them in the 70s, but one might certainly also have worn them, in the 17th century. People have also noticed that she mentions June 2nd as her, wedding, anniversary. That is the starting date of the Salem witch trials, June 2nd, 1692. So that is a fun little detail. There's also another detail in this episode where you see in the opening credits, the movie theater is playing Oz the Great and Powerful, a bit of anachronism to include a 2013 film, right, on the movie marquee. Mm-hmm. Oz the Great and Powerful is about battling witches, right? Three battling witches. That is something to keep an eye on. We've already mentioned the pendant that she wears,
and how it matches the pendant that Agatha Harkness wears in the comics. It's got, it seems to have the triple goddess motif, the Mother Maiden Crone image on the, so that's another sort of like wake the goddess within. And then they seem to be talking about she and the neighbor, according to the closed captions, seem to be talking about Wanda's tummy in this episode, which to me gives off some hardcore Rosemary's Baby stuff, which we will talk about a little bit more. But how do you feel about these? Oh, and she's like riding her bike, like a classic Wicked Witch of the West sort of Wizard of Oz thing. So how do you feel about all these like witchy clues gathering around the character of Agnes?
I'm 100% convinced that she's Agatha Harkness.
Yeah.
My only question is, what is her allegiance?
Yes.
But I think all of the things you mentioned, especially the pendant, you know, and the dates and all of those things. There was also a character named Ralph Hall who was among those tried during those persecutions. And she's always cracking wise about her husband, Ralph.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know if maybe that's coincidence. Might be digging a little deep, but if they're, I think these are things that are meant to be little puzzles or little breadcrumbs, however you want to, whatever metaphor you prefer, to help add a little extra flavor or interest to people who want to dive deeply. But also, I think you don't need to know them in order to enjoy the show.
Totally.
So I think these are just little things that are sprinkled throughout. But what makes me wonder about her allegiance is there's the bizarre scene in this episode where the neighbor is using his hedge trimmers and then the hedge trimmers are cutting into the wall and throwing sparks. One, hedge trimmers can't do that. Take it from a suburban dad who has cut his share of hedge trimmers. They'll cut through your extension cord easy enough, but they will not cut through a brick wall. And to me, as we find at the end of this episode, there's a bubble and there are sword agents trying to monitor it.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm jumping a little bit ahead here,
no.
Joanna, but Geraldine, in quotes, finds herself ejected from the bubble. And that's where we get our first look beyond WandaVision at the sort of this place. We've seen it on the screen, but this place where there's this activity seems to be happening under the dome, as it were.
Yeah.
you know, I think that this is, all factors together in a way that's meant to lead us in a certain direction.
You know, it's fun that, we're definitely gonna get to Geraldine and the dome. You're right, and we're gonna dive into that. But let's circle back to Ralph, her husband, Ralph.
So, but do you think I'm right that this was them cutting into the bubble in some way, like him trying to, you know, the image that Vision has of him cutting into the wall was some agent trying to either cut in or cut out.
I hadn't thought about that. To me, it seemed more like just like a glitch in the matrix sort of thing, like a representation of something that's wrong. In this world,
like typing all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. See, I thought it was like maybe this is somebody trying to cut in.
Oh, maybe.
Cut out.
Yeah, yeah. I hadn't
and
thought
he's
about
like,
that.
What are you doing? Because then later we see Agnes talking to that person.
Yeah.
And the wall is stitched up, patched up. So is she vexing him, bedazzling him, and patching the hole herself? Or is she in collusion, to use word, with the sword agent, and like, no, here's how we're gonna do this. Like, it looked like she might have been glamoring him a little bit. And of course, every time they read a magazine in this show, it's glamoring magazine.
Yeah, she also does, like, you know, she does like little magic-y hand movements sometimes and stuff like that. It's unclear to me whether there's a couple possibilities. Number one, Agnes is invested in keeping the bubble status quo, which is sort of your implication here. Number two, she's invested in escaping the bubble. Number three, she needs to keep the bubble status quo for now for her long game to escape it. Those are the three sort of
possibilities I see, and I'm not 1,000% sure I feel confident in any one direction. Because we're not, okay, so we're not sure, even if we accept that Agnes is Agatha Harkness and a witch with witchy powers, we're not certain at this point who the big bad of this season is. Is it Agnes? Is it Wanda herself who does some sort of, you know, some controlling, concerning things in this episode? Or is it a third party? And the third party is someone who I, like, dismissed last week, but I'm all in on it this week. So do you want to talk about Mephisto?
Well, I'll let you. I feel like I went deep on this other one. You hit me with Mephisto.
Okay, so who created this bubble is a big question. Did Wanda create the bubble in an attempt to keep Vision alive or bring Vision back from the dead? Did Wanda enter this bubble? We see Wanda and Vision driving into the bubble. Like, did they enter the bubble working with S.W.O.R.D. or someone else to figure out what the bubble was and how to, and did the bubble pre-exist? Was it Agnes's bubble? Was it Mephisto's bubble? Mephisto is a character from the comic books who is, essentially the devil. He's a devil-ish character, right? Mephistopheles, mm-hmm. Mephisto, right?
Yeah, taken from, obviously, Mephistopheles from the Faust story.
Right. So this idea, a lot of people have been suspecting that Mephisto would be involved because he is involved in a lot of Scarlet Witch stuff, especially as it pertains to her twin boys, which we will talk about in a little bit. So a lot of people have been expecting that Mephisto would show up here. I was just sort of like, I liked the idea of Wanda being her own worst enemy better than, like, the devil is here. But hey, if the devil's here, that's fine. A lot of people have noticed that in the promo and in the episodes themselves, the sixes are missing from the clocks. Sixes are definitely missing from various dials and clocks in this universe. There's some biblical imagery in this episode when Monica eats the apple. When she eats the apple, she gets sort of like expelled from the garden sort of thing. And so a lot of people think that Mephisto is actually the heretofore unseen Ralph, who you mentioned is possibly a fellow witch or something like that. How do you feel so far about what I've said?
I think that's possible, but yeah. I don't think it's going to go a lot further. I think Agnes is being set up as sort of the main antagonist, whether she's like a truly bad person or an entity or whatever she is or not. But I think there is a Ralph. She's name dropped Ralph.
Yeah.
Many, many times. And Ralph is a good sitcom name too, right?
Yes.
Like I mentioned Ralph Hall, he and his wife Mary were put on trial in like 1665. But it's also like Ralph Cramden, you know, Ralph sounds like the curmudgeonly neighbor, you know. And I'm with you on Mephisto. Mephisto's, I mean, literally looks like the devil in the comics that you would see like on a hot sauce bottle. Like he's pretty demonic. He's turned up in a few movies, primarily the Ghost Rider.
Yeah. Peter Fonda and Karen Hines. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And so,
well, I don't imagine that if Mephisto were to show up in this universe, he would look like the devil on the side of the hot sauce bottle. Actually, I have there's a really fun theory about who might be playing Mephisto, but please, please continue.
Is it Randall Park?
It's not. No.
I kind of think he would be a good Mephisto.
He would. He definitely would. But
partly because he has such a sunny personality.
Like, yeah.
A aw shucks kind of boyishness about him. And I think that would be kind of fun. But
there's a
what's your theory?
There's the line from episode two where Wanda and Agnes's neighbor says the devil's in the detail, and Agnes says that's not the only place he is. And there's just like a bunch of lines like that. Like this week she said Ralph looks better in the dark and all this sort of stuff like that. That just like makes people think that, you know, and like the unseen husband, the unseen spouse is a classic sitcom trope, right? Like Vera on Cheers or Maris on Frasier. You know, like that is a thing that happens. There was one on Will and Grace, Stanley, right? Stanley and Will and Grace, like that's a thing. But like, I like this idea of like, he's unseen, until there's going to be like a big reveal on him. Okay, before we get to like the, who might be playing him, do you want to hear my new favorite theory that we've already seen Mephisto / Ralph?
Okay.
In every episode so far, there's a significant animal. In episode one, there's like the lobster that gets thrown out the window and then winds up attached to the front door. In episode two, we've got the rabbit, who's named Senor Scratchy. Old Scratch is, of course, a name for the devil, who appears in episode two. And in episode three, of course, you've got this stork who is impervious to Wanda's magic, running around the joint. And in the comics, Mephisto turns himself into animals. So what do you think about this idea that we've already seen Mephisto three times in the show?
I think you're onto it. I think you got it. I think definitely. In fact, I'm more sold than ever on Mephisto.
Okay.
So, but like my whole theory... Okay, so let's get to your theory. I want to go back to Randall Park for a second.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this is what I think.
Okay.
I just think this would be cool.
Yeah.
Because he has turned up before as an FBI agent.
Yes.
In Ant-Man.
Yes.
And I think one thing that Marvel does like to do is reveal something about a character we've seen many times that gives us a new dimension on who that is. You know?
Yeah.
And so that's why I thought rather than have... Maybe he's a guy who's been, you know, in this guise for a long time, just sort of observing disruptions in the space-time continuum, and this is a platform for him to do that. And I just think it would be cool to make that character, give that character a little more dimension.
I am always in favor of Randall Park giving more to do. So I would not be upset about that in the slightest. The theory, so there's a couple other like clues that we're working. This is like, you know, this is kicking off my like internet detective vibes, like gathering quotes from various interviews. I spent some time on Reddit this morning, so I want to acknowledge like the animal thing did not come from me. I just really believe it. I think it's true. I think Senor Scratchy is
Senor
a real...
Scratchy. Senor Scratchy does it for me.
Yeah, I'm like,
okay, old Scratch, And then all the sixes, they're basically taking all the devil imagery.
Yeah, and maybe they're just messing with us, which could be possible, but yeah. Okay, so there's this big quote that Paul Bettany gave in an interview before the season started where he says, "I get to work with an actor that I've been wanting to work with forever who is just unbelievable. We have some real fireworks together." And elsewhere, I think he described that actor as legendary. So there appears to be, you know, Mark Hamill-esque at the end of Mandalorian season two, some big actor who has not been announced that will appear in the show. Okay. So I had a brainwave. I was like, oh my God, what if it's Dick Van Dyke? They've talked about like taking Dick Van Dyke out to lunch. Like maybe they got Dick Van Dyke to like play, not like he would do it for, not like he would like then romp into the MCU or whatever. Dick Van Dyke is an older gentleman. He's largely retired, but like maybe he could show up and, you know, Mephisto shapeshifts. So like maybe in one iteration, he's Dick Van Dyke and that could be really fun. And Paul Bettany would lose his mind, I think, to play against Dick Van Dyke. But there's actually a better theory going around.
He's 95 years old.
I know. There's a better theory. There's a better theory than that going around. And that is that it might be Bryan Cranston. Paul Bettany has mentioned Bryan Cranston, not in Breaking Bad, but in Malcolm in the Middle as an inspiration for his character. They've mentioned that one of the episodes is going to be, I thought the 90s episode was Roseanne, or the 90s episode may be Roseanne, but the early, they've mentioned Malcolm in the Middle several times and as an inspiration.
Malcolm in the Middle is very Roseanne. Like if you remember the original Roseanne show, like, it was like. It was like lower middle class family.
Yeah,
is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Not even just like because so many sitcoms are like these people live in a fabulous house, and you know, they're clearly like the dad is on TV and the mom has some other, you know,
right,
is a doctor, and like, right, it's just like that idea of like a family that really, if they get a flat tire, we're gonna have to cancel HBO, you know what I mean,
right,
to pay for that repair. So I think, yeah, Malcolm and Roseanne are not that far apart, although maybe separated by a couple decades.
So the Bobby and Kristen Lopez, who wrote all the theme songs, you know, they wrote a different theme song for every episode pertaining to whatever sitcom there is being referenced, right? And they mentioned in an interview with your old colleague, my pal Devin Coggan at Entertainment Weekly, that that there was a guest star that made some of the music they were writing particularly like meta. So either a guest vocalist or a guest star on the show. So perhaps Bryan Cranston, and they were looking at the Malcolm in the Middle like theme song as an inspiration. That's possible. But I love the idea of Bryan Cranston. Like, imagine a winky twinkly Bryan Cranston playing the devil. Like, come on.
Well, what's great about that is, for so many years on Malcolm in the Middle, Bryan Cranston was just like a total doofus.
Yeah.
Like almost another one of the boys, just a older version.
Yes.
Like, but very childlike in many ways. And then when he played Walter White on Breaking Bad, people were like, I mean, in a lot of ways was playing off that image, right? Here's this sort of like, let's say loserish dad, suburban dad.
Right.
Who gets some very bad news and then decides to break bad, to go to the dark side. And then like that's how it started with him and his whitey, kind of, I hate to call them whitey tighties because they weren't so tight. Like that sort of like baggy little boy underwear running around the desert, desperate. He became the devil incarnate as Walter White.
Uh-huh.
Like, he showed in many ways something we talk a lot about in our politics right now, which is like kind of ordinary, decent, run-of-the-mill people becoming hyper charged with darkness, with committing to like having like the worst elements of their personalities that are, you know, within all of us, drawn out and metastasized. And I think like Bryan Cranston can play like comical doofus and devil incarnate, and that's quite a range. So,
and I can also see him as being like paired with Katherine Hahn as a sitcom couple.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And so merging that in, yeah, this sitcom world that is literally blending those two things, I think is really genius. So let's hope that happens.
Chris Anderson, let me get the direct quote from Chris Anderson Lopez. She says, I can't spoil it, but there is a guest star on a decade that really brought a lot of authenticity. So that might be completely unrelated, but you know, just something to think about. So anyway, I have no evidence that Bryan Cranston is showing up as the devil on this show, guys. I think it's a theory that I really, really like. So let's get to the last reason why people are pretty convinced that Mephisto is involved in this show, and that has to do with the twins, Billy and Tommy. What do you know about Scarlet Witch's twin boys?
I know that in House of M, they don't exist.
Right.
So, I don't know much about them beyond that.
So it's kind of complicated, as comics often are, in terms of like creating and retconning. Like when they first show up, you know, Wanda has these babies with Vision, and I guess nobody asks too hard how it is that like an android was able to create some babies, but she has these twin boys, Billy and Tommy, and they're actually named for, named after the two things that were merged together to create Vision. Wonder Man, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, and I can't remember the other one. But and basically she has these twin boys, and then later in the comics, it is revealed that those boys were not actually like real babies that she gave birth to, but that she created them out of shards of Mephisto, of his soul. Think of them as sort of like Horcruxes. And if you're Potterversed, if you're listening and you're Potterversed, and later in the comics he reabsorbs them into himself to, like, you know, come to the full completion of his powers. That's why she's crumbling in House of M. They don't exist. Like, her twins that were real to her are reabsorbed into this villainous devil figure. And it's Agnes who erases her mind to sort of, or Agatha Harkness who erases her mind to sort of help her deal with the trauma of that. And when she discovers that that happens, she freaks out. So this idea that, you know, I talked to Richard about this a little bit in the first half, but didn't get into the Mephisto of it all. But in the second episode, there's that whole, like, repeated for the children, for the children, for the children thing that they're, like, sort of doing this creepy hot fuzz mantra. So what if, here's the theory, what if in this version of the story, whoever created the bubble, let's say it's Agnes or let's say it's Mephisto, needs Wanda to create these two children in order to, I don't know, escape or complete or do something. And so she's being used, even though she's somewhat in control of certain things, she's being used like Rosemary's Baby in order to create these soul shards that Mephisto needs?
Well, I think that's accurate. I think it's very likely. She has powers and abilities that I think a lot of these other figures we've been discussing really envy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think she's being exploited by them. They're trying to use her to create what they need. And she has the power to, you know, the word multiverse has become a really, it's become a popular trope now in comic book storytelling because it allows us to have various versions of the same characters and that please different fans. DC films and TV shows have really embraced this, right? We can have a Flash on TV and a Flash in the movies and they're all valid. And we can have a Batman from 1989 who's in a movie with Ben Affleck's Batman. And the Flash in DC is the one who breaks the physical barriers and opens the doorways to these various worlds. And I think in Marvel, that character is Scarlet Witch. She's the one who's able to break down these barriers, pull things from one dimension into another dimension. And while we're talking about all the casting of the upcoming Spider-Man film, including Andrew Garfield and perhaps introducing other versions of other Spider-Men, and we've seen Into the Spider-Verse, the fantastic animated film with the Miles Morales character encountering various other Spider-Men as well, I think Scarlet Witch is the figure in the larger official MCU that could do that here. And so naturally, I don't know how that fits into like creating characters out of shards and all that, but I think if you have characters who are banished to other dimensions or are trapped in sort of an in-between place, a sort of liminal existence, that that this bubble and this show of WandaVision becomes a place, it becomes a fulcrum where the storytellers can really leverage in this idea of alternate dimensions. And it's something that Marvel likes to do. They introduce various types of worlds in stages. So we began with the world of science, right? Tony Stark, Captain America, who's created through Super Soldier Serum, the Hulk. And then we extended to the cosmic realm with Thor and Doctor Strange opened the door to the world of magic. And I think that world here that Doctor Strange opened the door to is the one we are fully into now with WandaVision, is this world of magic. Magic being a kind of science.
Which is why we're talking about witches and devils. You know what I mean?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. The other implication of the twins here, whether or not they get reabsorbed or go on, you know, like, I can imagine that they're not going to stay babies given how quickly they, like, grew. I imagine they're going to age pretty quickly in this little pocket universe. We should note that, so even though the twins get reabsorbed into Mephisto in the comics, they're then discovered elsewhere later. This is classic comic stuff, right? Like, I think the fact that they were shards of Mephisto was, like, not, I don't want to say a retcon, but sort of like wasn't the initial plan. And then they're like, oh, what if there's shards of Mephisto? Cool. And he reabsorbs them and she goes, you know, mad because of it and stuff like that. And then this idea, then they find them later. So Wanda's two kids, Billy and Tommy, are known as Wiccan and Speed, and they are young Avengers. And the young, do you have any thoughts, Anthony, on how what we've seen from what Marvel has introduced so far, how we might be leading up to like a young Avengers story in the Marvel universe?
Well, Kate Bishop is one of the young Avengers as well. Right. And we're going to be getting a Hawkeye series with that character played by Hailee Steinfeld. So I know that's very likely to be a factor. I do think this is the kind of thing. Look, there are no Avengers currently because Endgame kind of wrapped that up. I think we'll get young Avengers before we get, say, West Coast Avengers. Right. which was a real thing for the comics. But I think that's a long game.
Right. But I think it's just sort of like, let's plant the seed here. Right. Oh, I'm not saying it's happening immediately, but like, it's sort of, it's not just, so there's Kate Bishop, which is Hailee Steinfeld in the Hawkeye show. They've recast Cassie Lang, Scott Lang's daughter, with the actress Catherine Newton. Cassie Lang is one of the young Avengers. And America Chavez, who's also been cast, is also one of the young Avengers, and she's going to be in phase four. So they're sprinkling in different projects, right? So they're sprinkling these young characters in these various Disney Plus shows and films, you know, potentially leading the path towards a young Avengers team up project. And I think it's a way to get people, you know, much the way that, like, you know, Tom Holland Spider-Man has gotten, like, you know, energized the franchise, gotten a younger generation as equally interested in MCU as people who, like, grew up with Iron Man and Captain America, stuff like that. Like, you know, keep the franchise young and fresh and interesting is, I think, something that they're, it seems like they're doing, you know, so. And we should note that one of Wanda's boys is canonically gay. So it could be an opportunity for more gay representation in the MCU, which would be great.
Overdue.
All right. So that's like the Mephisto and the twins of it all. But like, obviously, another big thing that happens in this episode is what happens with Geraldine. So, I feel like I've been babbling a bit. Anthony, do you want to talk about like Geraldine / Monica a little bit more and what you feel like is going on there?
Yeah, we had, I mean, we know that this character is not Geraldine, that she's, that's the identity imposed on her in this sort of fictional universe of the sitcom realm. But Monica Rambeau finds herself ejected from the bubble after taking a bite of the apple. Very biblical, again, relating to classic Judeo-Christian imagery tied to depictions of the devil. She's hurled out, and we see that there's this sort of dome where some events are transpiring. And I think the show is going to begin to split between a little more evenly between what's going on in the bubble where we've been completely immersed for a while and what's going on outside the bubble where people are trying to understand what's happening here. It reminded me of another story that was also adapted as a movie. It's not comic book related. And I'm not sure whether it was officially thought of as an inspiration or not, but it's the novel Annihilation, which was made into a movie in 2013, directed by Alex Garland. And it was written by Jeff Vandermeer, but of course was about this piece of a comet that falls to Earth and begins terraforming the planet, begins creating this bubble where mutations happen and one creature is merged with another and sort of otherworldly plants and animals begin to form. And I think that's what the ending of this episode reminded me of, is that you've got these government officials and scientists trying to understand what this means for us. What's happening here? Is the whole world going to become an 80s American sitcom or a 60s American sitcom? And who's doing it? What's happening?
Yeah.
So that kind of is where we're left for episode 4, is who's doing this, what's happening, and we are now outside the bubble getting a little bit of perspective on what exactly this show is. I will say my 11-year-old daughter, who loves Marvel and all the characters, has seen all the movies, watched all the TV show, well, all the cartoons and things like that. I'm waiting for my kids to watch WandaVision so they can watch it all together, because I think they'll enjoy it more if they get to this point sooner rather than waiting weeks to experience, oh, it's like this weird sitcom world. But she, on her own, started watching it. I caught her watching it on her iPad, and I was like, hey, so do you know what's going on? And she looked up at me and gave me a big smile and goes, I have no idea. She doesn't even really get – she doesn't even get the 60s sitcoms. Yeah, she's not watched those. So she's like, I have no idea what this means or what's happening. So I think, like, at the point where we get a little bit of grounding – in the real world, quote unquote.
Yeah.
It'll help everybody sort of orient themselves to what's happening under the bubble.
Yeah. It's really interesting. A lot of the feedback we got, you know, Richard read a couple, emails that we got, in the first half of the episode. And mostly the complaints that I've heard from people is that they're like, they want to get to the mystery already. They don't want to like spend too much time in the sitcom world. And I feel like those of us who got the first three episodes together as like a little preview package, like I wasn't worried about that because I knew that Monica gets booted in episode 3. So like, you know, we are outside the sitcom pastiche now, going forward. Not entirely, but like, you know, as you say, like we're going to get some external answers pretty quick now, I would say. What's unclear? So what's clear to me is that Monica Rambeau, what seems to be clear to me is that Monica Rambeau tries to get into this bubble to get to Wanda. As Agnes mentions, she doesn't have a home. The character of Geraldine doesn't have a home in the neighborhood. You know, she's an outlier for a number of different reasons. But what's unclear to me is how much it was that Geraldine was like pretending, that Monica was pretending to be Geraldine, and how much of it is she sort of loses who she is the closer she gets to Wanda and Wanda's reality warping abilities. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like a lot of people here are under her spell. And that Geraldine was able to break through, or Monica was able to break through, in a way that maybe some of the other characters can't. But when she talks about, you know, she's playing a character, a sassy sitcom character of some kind. And then her voice changes completely when she starts to talk about Pietro. So it's either that she like consciously dropped the act, or she broke through of the spell. For a second when she's talking about Wanda's brother, Pietro, who we will talk about a little more in a second. So I don't know. And I don't know how much Agnes is pretending or is also a little bit under Wanda's spell. And I don't understand. I don't know how much any of the neighbors are. And I don't know how much Vision is. Like, I think that's the question. Like, who's in control of what at what given time? And who's playing what part, you know?
Is this where we should dive into Wonder Man and the Grim Reaper?
Sure.
And so this is where I start to get a little cautious, because I think, all right, it deviates from the MCU, where the Vision was created in part using the brainwaves of this character called Wonder Man, who was a villain who became a good guy. It gets very soap opera. It's almost more soap opera than comic book, mm-hmm. although the two genres share a lot in common. But there's also this character of the Grim Reaper, who's the brother of Wonder Man, who hates Vision because he sees him as like an abomination, like as a mockery of his brother, the Wonder Man, this sort of bastardization, so to speak. And there's something that happens in this episode with the Vision that has him. It's not a power I remember ever seeing Vision actually have.
It's not.
Remember where he picks up the doctor and he can travel him super fast to the house.
Yeah.
And he can move with super speed. Like, I don't remember the remember Vision just being all, having all sort of Superman's abilities. So right. So this was new. He could fly, right? But he why he didn't just fly was curious to me. So I kind of wonder if we're really seeing the Vision here, who we know died when his Infinity Stone was ripped from his forehead in Infinity War. So is somebody inside the bubble playing the part of Vision?
So there's a couple, yeah, there's a couple fun options.
Is it Wonder Man?
Yeah, there's a couple fun options. Okay, so like here's one scenario.
I should finish the thought. Wonder Man can move with super speed, so yes. that's why we're drawing that connection.
Exactly.
I forgot to put punctuation.
Well, there's a couple fun options. Number one, let's say Wanda, in her despair at having lost Vision, recreates him somehow outside of the bubble. And that immense amount of power that it would take for someone to recreate someone like that is what caught the attention of maybe Mephisto and Agnes, right? That's an option, right? So she's created this Vision. And in doing so, she's given him some of her brother's powers, which is super speed. You know what I mean? Like, maybe that's something that happened, right? Another option is that there's this bubble that exists, this mysterious bubble that they're trying to figure out what it is. And they send Wanda in, but they don't send her alone. They send her with someone. And maybe who that person is Wonder Man. And maybe once she got inside the bubble, Wanda, in her, like, sitcom fantasy, where she has created this happily ever after for herself, turned her companion into Vision, when in fact he's Wonder Man, which would be a fun nod to the comics of, like, Wonder Man is sort of the basis for Vision, right? So maybe that's actually Wonder Man, who she's sort of spelled into looking like or thinking that he's Vision, right?
Yep.
And then a third one is that it was someone already in the bubble, Mephisto himself, etc., who was playing the part of Vision. That could be possible. But those are some options. I love the Wonder Man option, and here's a couple different reasons why. One, some eagle-eyed viewer on Reddit noticed that there is Wonder Man concept art in the photo, in the background of an interview that Jack Schaefer gave for, like, a package. There's, like, Wonder Man art on the wall, right? Which is fun and interesting. I would like it to be Wonder Man, and I would like Wonder Man to look like Paul Bettany. That's what I would like. Because I want to keep Paul Bettany. But, like, it would be kind of fun if it's Wonder Man. And that way Paul Bettany can, like, exist on in the MCU. Like, Vision's dead, but Paul Bettany lives on, sort of thing. Wonder Man is canonically, in the comics, he's an actor in real life. Like, that's his alter ego, Simon Williams. So, you know, maybe they gave Wanda a superhero actor to go into this bubble with her to help her with whatever pretense she was going to have to try to, like, perform. Basically, I think she got ensorcelled into the bubble and then is so powerful that her fantasy took over the bubble. That seems to me to be what we're looking at here. Does that make sense?
It makes sense to me.
Okay.
It does.
All right.
I think I like that we're kind of like doing a little detective work here and narrowing it down to like a couple of different suspects and possibilities. And that's what you've got to do.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. So these are just like some fun, likely stories. Once again, inspired by like smarter people than I am on the internet. And also definitely a lot of it comes from our producer, Dave, who talks to me all the time about WandaVision. Something to note in this episode that I think is interesting when Geraldine/Monica gets kicked out of the bubble is that her 70s clothes stay on her. So this idea that like what Wanda creates in there can exist outside of the bubble, which I think is interesting.
That's interesting, too. It has implications for whether some of these creations, these children, these other beings can exist outside.
And then
the bubble is burst.
A couple other quick things, then we can be done. One is both Matt Shakman in the interview this week and Kevin Feige in the interview last week talked about the aspect ratio shifting. You'll note at the end of this episode, as we move from Wanda's... one last thing about a created Vision. Some people are wondering if, like, you know, this isn't Vision, it's Wanda's Vision, WandaVision sort of thing. the aspect ratio shifts from the 70s framing, and then it expands out to full widescreen when we're in the external world. So just to keep an eye on those aspect ratios when you're trying to figure out, this is a trick that Westworld used all the time, when you're trying to figure out what's real and what's not, look at the aspect ratios, and maybe that'll help you to know. The hex imagery is something that a lot of people have pointed out. That's in the comics, Scarlet Witch uses hex bolts, and there's a lot of like hexagonal design work in the show, which is just like a fun detail. And then the last thing I want to talk about before we go is Quicksilver. So what are your thoughts about Pietro being name dropped in this episode, and what could it mean for the future, Anthony?
Oh boy. So obviously Pietro is a big part of Wanda's past and her present and her future, just as anybody who loses a beloved sibling carries that with them their whole lives. But question is, what's she going to do about it? She's lost Vision. Maybe she has recreated Vision. Is she going to try to bring Pietro back? You know, there are some rumors. I don't know how deep we want to get into that, because I know we've pledged not to be too spoilery, but
I think we'd say it's a rumor, because it's not confirmed. So I think we can say casting rumors.
Casting rumors suggest Evan Peters is going to be on this show, and he played Pietro in the X-Men, which is a separate universe from the MCU. And if we're going to get into Wanda slicing holes in various dimensions and bringing characters in from other universe, other realms, other in universe now substitutes as other movie franchises. That'd be kind of a cool thing. If she wants to summon her brother, bring her brother back, and she ends up with this version that's not quite the brother she knew, but
it came back
dimension.
Wrong.
Yep.
I like the idea that both there's a theory that maybe both Aaron Taylor Johnson and Evan Peters will be in this season. And that could, like you were talking about some of the Spider-Man 3 casting, that could help drive home this idea of a multiverse, right? This idea of like there are multiple Quicksilvers. So Paul Bettany has said, so next week's episode, the 80s episode, it's a Family Ties episode. And Paul Bettany has said in interviews that this is based on a very famous episode of Family Ties where Tom Hanks plays.
Oh my God.
The, what?
Okay, sorry. I remember this episode vividly.
Yeah, yes. He plays the fun uncle who actually winds up being having an alcohol problem. So, like, some people are like, if we're bringing in an uncle, could it be Uncle Pietro? Could this be where Evan Peters and or Aaron Taylor Johnson arrive in the show in next week's episode to stand in for the Tom Hanks figure? What do you think, Anthony?
As long as he drinks from a bottle of vanilla extract in order to get drunk, I'm okay with the. That has to be part of the homage in some way. Every time I make French toast or cookies or a cake and I use vanilla extract, I think of Tom Hanks drinking it because he could find no other alcohol in the Keaton's household. Every time.
Yeah, it's classic sitcom episode. A very young Tom Hanks. When he was still sort of like a skinny little comedian, so you might want to go check that out to prepare yourself. It could be that, like, maybe it's not going to be Pietro. Maybe it's going to be Agnes. They call her Auntie Agnes, so maybe Agnes will take on the Tom Hanks role. You don't know. We don't know. But it could be. This could be, they drop him at the end of they name drop at the end of this episode. He's on her mind. He's on Wanda's mind. Maybe Wanda tries to manifest him, and maybe in doing so, that's an inciting sort of rip in the multiverse or something like that. Who knows? But I'm excited for that possibility.
A very special episode of WandaVision.
I think so. You know, they've originally they said there weren't going to be episode titles. They told me that,
But they have given them titles. Don't Touch That Dial was one of them. So I do like the idea of episode 4 being called a very special episode. Mm-hmm. I think that would be really fun. The very last thing I want to say, and you actually gave me this idea, so thank you for it. They keep calling this show a love story, right? And we've suspected that the main love story at play here is Wanda and Vision, and Wanda's desire to hold on to Vision, this love of her life whom she's lost, right? But you mentioned Ralph as being someone who was killed at the Salem witch trials. So I'm like, okay, what if Ralph is Agnes's actual husband? And maybe he was the devil. You know, that was the whole thing in the Salem witch trials, that the witches were like consorting with the devil. Maybe he is a devil. Maybe he's just a powerful warlock, whatever. Maybe he dies, and maybe she tried to bring him back. And that was the inciting incident for the bubble in the first place. And so it's her love story as well, that she has suffered a similar tragedy and is similarly trying to hold on to someone she loved. And that would make her... you know, maybe she only got as so far as to turning him into animals, and she can't quite make him human yet. And that's what she needs the shards for. I don't know. This is me spitballing, but I do like the idea is this, like, this is a love story for her as well. And in that way, her story echoes with Wanda's, and Wanda's going to have to make the choice that mm-hmm. Agnes couldn't, which is to let Vision go. Do you know?
Huh. Yeah. Well, there's one correction I would
make. Oh, sorry. Sorry. Go ahead.
Which was that Ralph Hall and his wife Mary were not executed.
Oh, okay.
Ralph was acquitted.
Mm.
And this is, I think, slightly before the Salem witch trial, or somewhat separate, but he was acquitted, but his wife was not. She wasn't executed, but they maintained suspicion.
Mm. Okay.
So, like, maybe that's part of it, like that these characters sort of escaped the Salem witch trials and are still like floating around. But I'm not sure if there were actual witches that human beings would have been able to execute them in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They just used their powers to escape or destroy those threats. But yeah, but otherwise, yes, I agree with everything you said. It's just that I think Ralph and Agnes, they've survived. They're survivors.
Yeah, I think Agnes is either an unwilling sort of thrall to Ralph, mm-hmm. And given the very shots she takes at him, maybe that's the case. Or, you know, he's the love of her life, and she's trying to save him or rescue him somehow. Mm-hmm. Couple different possibilities there. Yeah.
I wonder if we went back and decoded some of her jokes, too. Because remember when the power goes out and she's like, that's okay, Ralph looks better in the dark. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, Ralph, if Mephisto looks like the hot sauce devil.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, maybe that's what she means.
Yeah, so, exactly. Pay close attention to her little, like, Ralph ribs. Things to look for in episode 4. Ralph jokes, an animal of some kind, her interest in the kids, and that bottle of vanilla extract. All right. Well, anything else? I mean, I feel like I have a better grasp of maybe what's going on. Yeah, we've got a couple different branching potentialities, but a better grasp on maybe something that's going on here. My understanding is that Randall Park, you know, he's playing an FBI agent. He's mm-hmm. still got his FBI jacket on in the trailer, so I don't know that he's working for S.W.O.R.D. yet, but maybe he's consulting for S.W.O.R.D. And then Darcy, you know, is a scientist. Basically, they need a law enforcement officer of some kind, an agent of some kind, and a scientist of some kind. They reached into their MCU pockets and plucked Kat Dennings and Randall Park, two sitcom actors, into this universe to fill those roles. So I feel like we're going to see Randall Park, Kat Dennings, and Tiana Paris as our external to the bubble crew. And then we've got our inside the bubble crew going on.
I feel like we're right where they want us to be. We're outside. We've got the lay of the land.
Yeah.
We're not sure where it's going.
Yeah. Sounds great. All right. Anything else you want to say before we see folks next week?
I'm good, man. Everybody stay safe out there.
All right. Stay safe. You can find me on, you can find both of us at vanityfair.com. You can find me on Twitter @JoeWroteThis. You can find Richard on Twitter @Rylaws. And Anthony, where can folks find you?
Just find me on vanityfair.com.
Perfect.
Writing up stories.
A perfect place to be. All right. We will see you all in back in the neighborhood next week.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.